I don't know if Podcast Village, I think they might have switched over to something even better.
Yeah. Did you say this SM7B? I accidentally cut out there for a second.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yep.
Yep. They're really good mics. I have one and I used it, but my voice is a little weaker. So I got laryngitis for like a month and a half. So I switched to an Audio Technica and I sounded better. So I use that now, but
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you sound pretty good.
Thanks. All right. Anything I should or should not promote?
Should or should not promote? Well, of course, I love to talk about White Noise and Playapod. Those are really the two things that I'm focused on the most. Yeah, I mean, I can talk about any topic. I mean, everything you sent me on Facebook's fine.
Cool. Do you still have the compulsive game out there?
I do. Okay. Yeah. Yep. It's one of my best video games I ever wrote.
I heard it advertised on the show, and then I got it. I was like, I played that for like 6 months straight.
Really?
So yeah, I really think that's a great game.
Thanks, man. We just, you know, the video games, they don't make that much money. So I ended up hiring a bunch of developers and focusing really hard on the game side and tried to build it. And it got to the point where I was just like, you know what? It was like 3% of the revenue. Like everything's white noise. That's where most of my revenue comes from. So
I use it all the time too.
Cool. Cool. Yeah. A lot of people do. It's amazing. So that's my number one app for sure. But yeah, I just kind of decided to focus in on the white noise and focus in on the audio apps.
All right, I am ready. I'm going to fire up the... I streamed to YouTube. Let's see here.
What did you mean by, I guess, what's like censorship limits?
Yeah, so, you know, when I talked to Bill Ottman at Minds.com, like, is there anything that is just too far for you? Or is that, you know, as a... with Playapod specifically, with the Overcast stuff, you know, Marco obviously had his limit with Alex Jones for whatever reason. But, I mean, do you take a very neutral approach, or is there anything that you'd go, man, I just don't want this in my directory, or that kind of stuff? So that's really what that means. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Got it. It's I don't know if I have a good answer. It's kind of like... when you're a small business, you cross the bridge when you need cross that bridge when you need to.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what Marco, I listened to that on No Agenda, and seemed like he was bullied into it, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Which is the name of the game now.
Mm-hmm. I think luckily Playapod's small enough where I'm not a target on anybody's list yet.
That's the crummy part, is that if you do this long enough and you get successful enough, then you've got a big target on your back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's how I ended up getting sued by the patent troll.
Yeah, let me put that in my notes here.
You know, that was because, well, you know, there's...
Here, let me hit the publish on the stream here.
And then okay.
Then we'll save it for the air.
Sure.
Because my boss screams at me all the time. I won't make you sit through the intro either. I'll add that in here in just a moment.
Okay.
All right, we're live. All right, welcome to We Are Libertarians, if you're watching on the live stream. My guest is Todd Moore. The name of the actual company is TM Soft. Yep. All right, cool. All right, joining me now on Skype is Todd Moore, someone that I have heard for years on one of my favorite, if not my favorite, podcast, The Mike O'Meara Show. And he's got his own podcast called The Tech 411 Show with Oscar Santana. And he runs a company called TMSoft, and I actually got in contact with Todd recently when he hit me up and said, hey, I've got this new mobile app that is a podcast player called Playapod, and I'd love for you to check it out. And this is not an advertisement. This is we got to talking about other stuff, and I wanted to talk to him about various ethical stuff in software and also a little bit about a story that he's got that libertarians are going to go, oh, wow, this is red meat. So, Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So let's tell the people who you are. You're probably your most famous app is an app that I actually use all the time. It's called something called White Noise, the White Noise app. I use brown noise mixed with kitten purrs.
Kitten purrs? That's a new one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an app. It's one of the first apps I ever wrote 10 years ago, and it's what I'm best known for because it's helping millions of people sleep better at night. And brown noise, believe it or not, that's one of the most popular sounds out of all the thousands of sounds that I've created. Brown noise is it's similar to white noise, which is like static, but it's got some really deep frequencies, a lot of bass, so it sounds more like a waterfall. A lot of people use it.
Yeah, it's just kind of pulsate. It's just very mellow. And it's really nice mixed with the kitten purse. So what are some other apps that you've created?
Well, the Playapod that you mentioned, and I've always been into audio, I guess you could say. That's why I wrote White Noise. And Playapod is how I listen to my podcast. And that's my most recent app that I've created because I was just getting frustrated with all the different podcasting apps. And originally I had an iPhone. I switched to Android, but when I was on iPhone, I did not like what Apple was doing to that app. They just made it more and more difficult to use, and that's what ultimately inspired me, I guess, to create my own.
Yeah, that's a cool skill. Like, if I'm really frustrated with this thing, I'll just make my own thing. And we'll talk I mean, everybody obviously is listening on a podcast app, so right. I agree with you. I think the Apple podcast app is so confusing, and iTunes in general, I think they just have totally missed the mark with some of it. I've mentioned before that I've used the Downcast app. I've been using Playapod for about the last week, and I really do enjoy it. Like, what was your philosophy behind building the app?
The progress bar. When Apple updated their podcast app for iOS 7, that's when they went all modern and trendy, they reduced the progress bar down to this like thin, beautiful little line, and it went edge to edge on the screen. You could never grab it. It was so hard to navigate. It was so hard to know what you've listened to, and they made it look really pretty. And this is something that Apple does a lot. They make really pretty things at the cost of functionality, and that drives me crazy. Nothing went wrong with making things look nice and shiny and great and pleasant to the eye. But as soon as you start adding additional clicks or additional taps in order to do a task that previously was easier to do, that's when you've gone off the deep end. And I think Apple kind of did that when they updated their app. And my biggest thing has always been, I just want to know what I've listened to. And if I fumble the phone or I drop it and it accidentally skips to the end or the beginning, I want to know and I want to be able to visualize what I've already listened to. No other app really does that. Yeah. They all show you where you left off, but nobody shows you the exact areas that you've listened to. And that was all I wanted to solve. And that was the first thing I wrote, was the progress bar.
That's cool. Yeah, and thank you for featuring the Chris Spangle Show. I saw that in there, and I do appreciate the plug there. That's
absolutely
nice. Yeah. So I wanted to have you on and talk, because you and I both listen to No Agenda, as we found out while setting this up. And I was listening to it a couple weeks ago, and they played a clip from someone named Marco Arment, who originally created Instapaper and has created a lot of services. And he's behind the popular Overcast app. And the Overcast app, I think, is okay. I was not blown away by it. I stuck with what I have basically been using for a decade. But in this clip, which I won't replay for the sake of time, he essentially talks about how he was getting messages from various people saying that, why do you support Alex Jones? Why do you have him in your directory? And so he thought about it, and he's like, you know what? You're right. Why am I supporting hate speech? And which hate speech is a totally nebulous term. And ended up removing him from the directory along with an NRA podcast. And so I felt it was important to say to my podcast listeners, you know, here's somebody that doesn't share your values necessarily, who feels that it is his job to censor content. And I have no idea what you're going to say, so I'd hate to put you on the spot here. But when you're building something like a podcast app, what is your philosophy behind the content that goes into it, and what ethical concerns do you really, like when you're putting together apps in general, how do you think about the ethical use of these various services? That's kind of an esoteric question, so I hope you get what I mean. But I think he's clearly playing editor with some of it, and I wondered, why would somebody do that, and what would your response be to someone that said you're supporting hate speech?
Yeah, that's tough. And fortunately, I haven't had to go through that specific example. I get a lot of emails from customers, and I tend to make sure there's a pattern of you know, not just one angry person, because you're always going to have one angry person out there that is upset over something. And if I listen to every single one of those kind of one-off things, I think the applications that I write might get pulled in a direction that would upset more users than not. And I think in that kind of case of Alex Jones, and I don't believe he's hate speech. I've always just thought of him as kind of a conspiracy theorist entertainer. So I don't see what the big deal was. If you hate him, just don't listen to him.
I was listening to his show yesterday before we started, and man, is he off the rails. Like, he's talking the interdimensional shape-shifting alien stuff. It's like he's not been a part of public discourse for so long in the first place. Like, if you share an InfoWars link, everybody pounces on you for sharing an InfoWars link.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that, to me, it's like I don't know what I think. I'd have to get a lot of requests to have a certain podcast, or I'd have to listen myself and make my own judgment on it. And that's what I always try to do, especially with the media today, is I don't just take someone else's opinion that I hear online or hear in the news. Like, if something's really going to anger me and I'm going to get upset, I'm going to want to dig a little further to make sure that, you know, it's entirely truthful. And to be honest, I didn't even listen. I've never really listened to Alex Jones. And as soon as this story came out where he was censored on all these different platforms, and it was more than just iTunes, MailChimp, so now he can't even send a newsletter. It was like they all...
Pornhub. It was literally 15 services within about 24 hours. Spreaker, iHeartRadio, all these different services.
LinkedIn, and it's like, right. What? Don't you want him to have another job? Right. Like, what are you doing? And that's what really scared me, was this... it was coordinated, what happened. And to me, that's the scariest thing. And the only company that said, no, we're not going to do it was Twitter. And I'm not sure why they eventually kicked him off for a little bit, but, that's scary to me. I'm not, digging this censorship stuff that seems to be happening more and more. And I don't really know what the best solution is. I think it comes down to, and I've always felt like, your biggest vote in life is what you spend your money on. And I believe that politically as well. And I think when you're in these situations, do you really want to support those platforms if you don't agree with that censorship? Or do you want to find other platforms that are not going to censor the shows that you want to listen to or the politics that you want to listen to? And I think things have just gotten a little out of hand. So with PlayApod, I'm not censoring anything, but I do use the public API for iTunes, which which is basically using their podcast directory. And I know Marco does that as well because it's so easy to do and it's always just worked great. And it's it returns results in a good order, putting the most popular at the top. And I did that initially because I didn't want to invest the time in building my own database and my own solution and going around the internet collecting all these different shows. So,
well, it's also a negative for you from a user experience, because if I'm in there Googling my favorite podcast and it's not in there because you're not aware of it. I mean, I keep a list of libertarian podcasts at libertarianpodcast.com, and I've got 300 maybe 400, and every time I share it, I get another one going, why am I not on this list? I mean, and that's such a very narrow specific thing. I mean, that would be really hard, I think, to build your own directory.
And I'm a small business, so I do most of the software development. I have another developer that helps out, mostly works on the Android side, and I do the iOS side. And so, I mean, we're a business of five people, so you want to save time. And so if you can use open source code, that's great. If you can use these public directories like yours or Apple, like, that just saves a lot of time. And you can focus on the things you want to really do, which is, for me, was that progress bar and how you can display what you've listened to. So it's all about like cutting corners and saving time. And but now, you know, after all this has happened, it's like, well, we kind of need... can we trust Apple with that data? Can we trust these big companies with an open podcast directory? And I know from No Agenda, Adam Curry is looking into creating this open directory. And I hope someone does, because I would prefer to plug into that.
Yeah, and that's the hard part. So I talked about Cody Wilson, who's the 3D printed gun guy. Mm-hmm. And in the last episode on Tuesday, and we talked about the service he created called Hatreon. You might remember it. And so
I listened to the show.
Okay, well, thank you.
The fascinating guy you interviewed.
He built this thing specifically for white nationalists. Just because of the principle of free speech, he's like, you know what, it's unfair that they get kicked off of these services, and eventually got shut down. And it's really, you got to have a lot of guts, especially if you're trying to make payroll. I mean, I grew up with a small business owning father and mother, and then, you know, obviously trying to start a business with this. I get the pressures because margins are so tight, and especially if you've got payroll and you've got people that depend on your income and your own income, it's hard to make some of those decisions. I mean, so is this awakening you to maybe there's a problem and I want to do something different? Or have you had like a long, deep set, I want to support the First Amendment and I'm going to take some risks? I mean, where are you kind of at on that spectrum?
That's a great question, because I have to operate under the rules of the app stores. And that's the other issue. So when you create an app, I have to follow Apple's guidelines when I publish on the App Store. And then when I go to the Google Play Store, I got to follow their guidelines. And I have really good relationships with both Apple and Google. And I certainly would not want to jeopardize that in any way. So it puts me in a bad spot, because I want Alex Jones to be in my directory, because I think it was unfair. I think he's been bullied out of all these platforms, and I don't like bullies. And so, you know, but then I have to weigh that with, well, will that upset, you know, the platforms I've published my apps on, my own apps, and could that be, could I get kicked out of the App Store, which would basically ruin my company?
Right.
So that's the tough thing that I have to figure out. You know, how far do I want to go? And you look at, you know, social networks like Gab, who's been kicked out of all the stores, and it becomes really difficult then to get visibility and for people to find your application. So you got to find the right balance.
I empathize with you, because I'm really, my business has been social media marketing. I mean, that's really how I've made a career. That's why I was hired at my current job. It's how I've grown this. And so in a lot of ways, I feel betrayed by the last year or so with these big tech giants, because it's It's like, I was so excited about the promise of free speech and to see them give in to China, to give in to the United States government, the Israeli government, and give in to government censorship across the board. It's kind of like, and also the censorship of conservatives. I feel betrayed and kind of a little bit like, man, where do we go from here? Because it's now kind of consolidated around these four or five big companies. And do we have a diaspora where it all kind of breaks apart with another clearing of the house, like the 1998 crash? Or does it just kind of continue down this road? I mean, where do you think that small creators and people like yourself and myself who have invested 15 years of skills into these services, I mean, maybe it was dumb on our part to invest in somebody else's house, but it's been such a draw. I mean, have you thought about what's next for me, or how do you make that balance?
Yeah, that's not easy. But the one thing I like to view it as, I guess, is I believe there's going to be a lot of opportunities, because if we really only have four or five platforms being run by these giant companies and they're all anti-conservative, I mean, to me, I hate that, you know, because I think everyone should be able to give their opinions and not be censored. But if they're all one way, I think that's just opening up opportunity for someone to come in who can create new platforms, you know, the new Facebook, ones that value your privacy, ones that may even offer ad-free solutions, which, you know, today all these products are free and they just sell your info and throw gobs of ads in your face. And if I could speak to that some too, because that's not one, it's not a great experience, and two, your data is probably being sold, and well, it definitely is being sold. And at some point you have to just decide, do I want to protect my privacy, or am I okay just, you know, for the free stuff, just giving everything about me away?
Yeah, I was listening to an interview with head the publisher of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he was basically saying, we have such big overhead because of the printing and the delivery and all that goes into it. You know, we have a third of the audience of Sean Hannity, for instance, but we have quadruple the overhead. And so when we moved into Philly.com and a digital strategy, we were late to the game, because then all of a sudden social media came in and we were getting $30 per ad spot. Now we're getting $1 per ad spot because they had such targeting built into all of their different various ad buckets. That was on the Michael Smirkanish program today. And I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I know you build games, for instance. Has there been the temptation? So at work, you know, connected to a big media company, they now will buy, you know, location data essentially. And a lot of it comes from games or addicting type apps. You know, you have a game called Compulsive that I really like. I spend a lot of time on Compulsive. Has there been the temptation to throw location services on that? You know, the consumer won't really notice, but then I can track some of that data and then sell that to a reseller and make some extra cash. I mean, where are some of those ethical concerns? How do you work that out in your mind?
Yeah, see, I kind of value people's privacy. So when I wrote all my video games, I didn't want your email address. I didn't want your location. I just wanted to focus on making a fun game. And the hope was, you know, through in-app purchases or a few banner ads that I could put in there, you know, it would help pay for the development costs. It's probably why I no longer make video games, because I really believe you if you really want to make money, you have to do so much. And what it ends up being is you become an analytics company, because you have to know every little thing about what your customers are doing. You have to analyze all the different pathways they've taken through the video game. Where are people dropping off? Where are they coming back? Where are they spending money? And it's just a massive amount of analytics that's going on that helps the game developers produce a piece of content that will yield the most money out of you. And it's really that scientific. And to me, I was just I'm bored by that stuff. I just wanted to make video games. You know, I wanted to make fun video games and not spend all my time trying to figure out who my customers were and figure out what they're doing exactly and how I can monetize them in the best way possible and get the most yield and this and that. It's kind of, if you knew what I did, you probably wouldn't even play these mobile video games, because that's what it's all about. It's all about figuring out how to squeeze people the most, to keep them inside your app the longest. And how do we get the most money out of them? And I don't know. It's just, I always looked at it like, I just want to create something fun, you know?
Right.
And I don't think that's kind of what the video games, where we're at today with video games, because it's all very, very analytical. And it's a little scary when you think about it.
Well, I just get so frustrated that I don't have enough gems for Kingdom Rush. And I've probably given whatever the head company of that is, I've bought somebody a car over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, there's a feeling of frustration. You're like, oh, I want to do this thing, but I can't. And they're going to let me if I buy this thing. And yeah, it does. Yep. In hindsight, it does feel really manipulative and gross.
It is. And it is. And it's all about dopamine. It's all about, you know, that feeling you get, that high you get when you're playing. And I don't know. I obviously wasn't very good at that part of the business. I've never been. I don't want people's information. And so, you know, I just want to make apps that people like and find useful. But it's really tough, though. It's tough because all of my, I would say the majority of all my revenue that I've made has come from free apps. And of the free apps, it's all advertising. It's not in-app purchases. That's a very small percentage. So same with paid apps, a very small percentage. And I always pay for apps because of the truth is, when you don't pay for an app and there's advertising in there, that does two things to your phone. It burns up your battery and it burns up your network. And you're obviously giving private information about yourself. They're figuring out who you are and what you're doing and what kind of ads work best for you. And all of those things combined, I think it's worth paying 99 cents and just having zero ads. Your battery and your network connection will thank you for it.
Yeah, I think I paid for the white noise because I just don't want the ads. And I figure somebody somewhere is building this thing and probably has a company and wants to, you know, take their significant other out to a meal. And it's 99 cents. And so if I'm going to use this, you know, several times a week, why not support that creator? Does it concern you some of the things that people like Sean Parker have come out and said about the manipulation of your brain? You mentioned dopamine in building of not only social networks, but a lot of what we see on our phones. I can tell you that since I got my phone in 2010, when I got the iPhone, I have much harder. I don't read as well. My attention span isn't as good. I don't feel as connected to people. I'm less happy. I mean, have you thought about that from a developer perspective? And what is your perspective on the way that these phones change our brains?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just look outside when you're driving and people aren't even looking where they're going anymore. They're staring right at their screens. They're totally addicted. And these apps are kind of like different drugs that are competing for your attention. And, you know, Google and Apple, I think, have realized how unhealthy this is. And so now they're baking into the platforms, you know, they're letting you know how much time you're spending in each app. And they're trying to help, like they're trying to help the addictions that they in fact created with these platforms. And that's kind of where we're at right now.
I saw when I logged onto YouTube, I got a notification like, hey, track your time on YouTube and see how much time you're watching YouTube.
Yeah, that's where we're at right now. They realize that they've created something unhealthy and they're going to throw more technology at it to fix the problem.
Like, did you realize this sooner than other people because of your business?
Well, again, if you look at my apps, like White Noise, you use it 8 hours a night, but you're sleeping. So you're not actually, you know, usually interacting with the White Noise app. And when you're using PlayApod, you're usually either being entertained or you're trying to learn something, as it's, you know, strictly an audio app. So, you know, those are the apps that people use the most. Like you said, I did a bunch of video games, which were not as, successful for the reasons, I just listed. But I think for the most part, I like building apps that truly are useful and help people. And I think that's, I don't know, I guess that's always been my goal, even though the video games, you can say, I don't know how that helps people. It entertains you. It's fun.
Sometimes you just need a mindless distraction for a second. Take your mind off of whatever you're worrying about. But yeah, the reality is that if you want to be successful, you kind of have to be a dirtball person in this world. Like, I feel like...
I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, like, and I was talking to somebody else about that today. This friend was just going off, like, why don't I just steal from the government and steal from my company? And I've noticed this trend that maybe, you know, the whole Atlas Shrugged idea is coming true, where producers are just going, why am I producing? What's the point of it? You know, because if you do get too successful, it's like the problem for Alex Jones is that Alex Jones had a great life and a good company, and then Donald Trump won, and then he started getting attention because people can't accept the fact that Hillary Clinton is awful, and so he's now too successful and we've got to tear him down. I mean, you've actually tasted a little bit of that yourself with patent trolls, haven't you?
Yeah, and early on with my White Noise app, I got targeted by a patent troll, which is nothing more than a shell company that was run by a lawyer who gets some patents and then sues a bunch of people. Like in the case of White Noise, they said that a hyperlink that I had in my app was violating their patent. And I'm talking, you know, the hyperlink, you click on this, it takes you to the internet. How can you have a patent on a hyperlink? It doesn't make any sense. And so you get these kind
of, let me pause. Just so we're clear, it wasn't any kind of specific link. It was literally just the fact that you were using the hyperlinking technology that got you run afoul of these people.
Well, it was a little more specific. It was a link. So it was in the free app, and it was a link to the full version, which was 99 cents. And you would click the hyperlink, and it takes you to the app store. So pretty much a hyperlink. But the way they looked at it is they said, well, we own the patent on that process. And so their whole demand letter was like screenshots of the app store, clicking the buy button in the app store. And I'm like, wait, most of this is all Apple. What are you doing? You know, that doesn't make any sense. But they're not going after Apple. They're going after the small guy.
So how did you resolve that?
Well, when you're a small business and you get a demand letter, most people just go, I'm going to ignore it, because you could hire a lawyer right there, and you could spend a ton of money and issue a response and come up with all the reasons why you're not violating their patents. But at the end of the day, they don't care. They're going to sue you no matter what. They just want money. In fact, they don't even really want to go to court. In fact, they never traditionally do go to court. They send you a demand letter. They say, give us money and we'll go away. It's extortion. And if you don't, they'll file a lawsuit, and then they'll bleed you dry in discovery, and you end up spending, you know, millions of dollars on a lawyer to defend yourself, where it's what they really want you to do is just give them some cash and they'll go away. And that's their whole, you know, business model. And it's disgusting. It's total extortion, and it's happening more and more now because it's so lucrative for people to do this. And I would meet other CEOs, because I really got involved in this and I learned as much as I could. And it wasn't just me. It's just everyone is being attacked, small, medium, and large. It used to be just the big guys, you know, the Apples and the Samsungs suing each other for billions of dollars. That's no longer the case. They go after small guys, too. So what happened? How did I get out of it? They did file a lawsuit in the Eastern District of Texas. This is where all the patent trolls like to file their lawsuits. It was such a frivolous lawsuit. I actually had a lawyer represent me pro bono. Hmm. And it's probably the first time ever in a patent lawsuit to be represented pro bono, especially in a mobile app business. So he got involved, ended up writing a response and talking through the patent trolls. And the interesting thing is, when he spoke to, because I never spoke to these guys on the phone, these jerks, so, but he did. And he was like, yeah, they were even kind of confused why they sued me, and it seemed like it was personal, and that's why they sued me. And so the only thing I could think of is, you know, I do that podcast called Tech 411. We discussed this patent troll on that show.
Oh.
It was like one of the first episodes. And at the time, my podcast was being featured on iTunes. It was getting tons of downloads. Mike O'Mara was promoting it, and it had a lot of it. So again, I had a target on my back for white noise. I had a target on my back for having a popular podcast at the time. I don't know what it was. I don't know if they were coming at me because they thought white noise was making a ton of money, or if they actually listened to the podcast I was on where I was throwing them under the bus. But one of those reasons is why they ended up filing the lawsuit. But in the end, they realized I had a pro bono lawyer. They realized I was going to fight, because why wouldn't I? He's free. But, you know, in even Marco even mentioned this, because he read my blog article, and he was like saying this was the only reason they dismissed the lawsuit is because I had a pro bono lawyer. So there was no real solution to the problem. I got out of it because, you know, my lawyer was working for free. And that's what their lawyers are doing, right? Their lawyers work for free. They're working to get some percentage of you know, all of these extortions that are going on. And they're sending out thousands of letters to lots and lots of,
so
lots
because,
of people.
Because there was no churn, you know, and I say that in that lawyers, if you hire a lawyer and they hire a lawyer, what happens, I've seen this in friends' divorces. I fortunately didn't have to have one of mine, but the lawyers start getting together and just churning money. Like, and they chit chat all the time and then bill you for it. And, you know, and it just, yeah. So that's unbelievable. So because there was no profit motive, they weren't interested.
Yeah, well, they agreed, and they tried to get some money out of me. They're like, why don't you just give us a few $1,000, we'll go away. And then they came back at half the price, and then they came back and said, well, how much will you pay? How much will you give us? And I said, nothing. I'm going to pay you nothing. And they go, okay, that sounds good. And we ended up getting it dismissed. And see, most of the time what they do is, when they get something out of a company, they make you sign an NDA, and so you can't talk about it anymore. You've been censored from talking about it. And so we really don't know how serious this problem is, because most of these companies, they have no other option but to settle and sign an NDA just to keep their companies alive. So the problem really is much bigger than I think everyone thinks it is.
That's horrible. How has no one solved this? Because obviously it's using the law to punish people. It's lawfare. So there should be a legal remedy to it. How has no legislator, federal or, you know, even in the states, I mean, have there been discussions about fixing this?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Fixing that particular court?
And this is when it gets interesting, because I spent my whole life not being political at all, like not getting involved in politics. And so when this happened, which was about 5 years ago, Bob Goodlatte here in Virginia, he actually created some legislation. It was called the Innovation Act. And it was a pretty good bill, and it plugged many of the holes that these patent trolls use. And so I ended up getting invited to testify before Congress and to share my story with everyone. And so I started getting involved, and I started meeting with lots of different senators and congressmen and telling my story. I mean, I was going down on the Hill a lot, and we were going to get this bill passed, and that was the goal. And everybody was on board, and it felt great because this was really my first time I ever advocated down on the Hill for anything. And everybody was listening, and everybody wanted to solve the problem. And then right at the end, when it was time to bring it to vote, it was shut down. It was killed. And I didn't understand why. And it was Harry Reid who killed it and said, we can't get the votes for this. But it was so, it made me so mad because everyone was on board. This was bipartisan. Everybody wanted to solve the problem. We're going to fix it. This is a great bill. We're coming together. You know, this was before Trump, and you know, where, you know, people were still working together on the Hill to find solutions. And so that really was eye opening. And then I spent the year after doing the rounds down there on the Hill. And to be honest, Chris, I never even once thought, is this person a Democrat or are they a Republican? Didn't care. Didn't even really know the difference, to be honest with you. And now I do. Like, it was just so eye-opening. The Democrats were all against it, but they were all for it. And the Republicans have always been for it. And trying to figure out what happened has been really eye-opening. It really has.
Who got paid what where?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it turns out Big Pharma was against it. Hmm. Big Pharma was against the Innovation Act. They thought from their perspective that it would weaken the patent system. And in turn, because they have a lot of patents, they research, spend a lot of money on drugs and researching drugs, and they patent these things. And, you know, patents are good for 20 years. They get a monopoly on a drug. I mean, they don't want their current business model to be weakened. And I totally understand that. I get it. But really, I didn't see how this applied to them, because this was really about stopping frivolous lawsuits. It wasn't stopping or weakening the patents. I thought it improved the strength of the patents. I'm a guy who, I'm listed on 5 or 6 different patents. I know how the patent system works, and I understand how it can be beneficial. I think today the patent system has gotten out of hand. I think there's just so much crap. There's so many vague patents, just like in the hyperlink example I gave earlier. There's so many patents that are just like, all right, this computer talks to this computer and says to do this one thing, and they write these things really vague so that you can just use any patent to sue anybody now. And that's the real problem we have. We have a quality problem in our patent system, and it should be, to have a patent, it should be unique and non-trivial, and it's not. These patents are getting approved, and you're just like, what? Taking a photo with a white background? That's a patent? How did Amazon get that patent? So now Amazon can sue anyone who shows a product on their website and uses a white background? That's a real patent. Doesn't make sense. And you got the one-click thing. It's probably everyone's heard of the one-click patent that Amazon had that everyone freaked out about a long time ago. But it's just these obvious things are getting patented, and it should be difficult to get a patent, but it's really not.
It's like Adam Carolla basically rung the, he got one of these letters, and they basically said, we own RSS feeds or something. It wasn't RSS feeds, but it was media.
A lot about that.
Yeah, it was media enclosures in RSS feeds, I think. And so he came on on my day job show. He went on the tour and basically fought these guys, and I think ended up winning. But it was scary because it's like, I just have a podcast. I'm just a dude. I mean, at the time I was spending so much money. I was not making any money. And it's like, if I get one of these letters, I'm just going to have to stop doing my podcast.
Yeah. You either have to shut it down or pay some money. And they, yeah, I'm pretty familiar with the podcasting patent as it became known. And I contributed to that. The EFF was, you know, they helped Adam out. And I, they, we, that patent is finally gone. It's been demolished, but it took years and years and it took a lot of money, to get it voided. And the patent itself was, these guys came up with a way to create a playlist. It was all about the playlist. That's what the patent was. And they tried to make a product a long time ago where you would call in and go, okay, I want this, this, and this. And then they put it on a cassette tape and they mail it to you. So that's the patent. That's basically what the patent. They never made any money off the product, but they've been sitting on this patent for 20 years. You know, we're back in the cassette days. And it was about to expire. You know, you got a 20-year limit on the patents. So they go, well, let's just try to make some money. We got a couple years left on this thing. And they sued, yeah, they sued all these podcasts. And they said they are the creators of the playlist. And they sued Apple, and Apple ended up paying them. So they got a lot of money out of Apple. And then they just went from there and started suing podcasters because what's an RSS feed? Well, it's basically a playlist, right? So, yeah, they own that now. So yeah, it was crazy. But
I know this is sort of a weird question in light of the previous conversation, but, I mean, why doesn't Apple or these people with deep pockets like an Amazon, Apple, Google, or whomever who are more – they're a better corporate – they're a better citizen – of the United States than these patent trolls. Okay, we may not think they're great, but at least they're much more transparent-ish. Why don't they just start buying up all these patents if they're getting dinged with these patent lawsuits all the time?
Yeah, and Google even started a program where they just wanted you to sell all your patents to them. And that's the way that, I mean, that was their only solutions to date is, well, we'll just start buying them all up. And of course, there's these big patent clearing houses that make a ton of money that sit on, you know, thousands and thousands of patents that you can license so that no one will sue you. It's a huge moneymaker, these patents, owning patents, suing people that may or may not violate your patent. Newegg is a company, if you've heard of them, they sell like tech gear.
Yeah.
They were extremely good about suing and defending themselves, not suing, but defending themselves against patent lawsuits. And, they figured out a cost effective way to do it. And it really benefited them because, you know, as they always say their story, they don't actually make anything. They just sell other people's stuff, but they're getting, you know, they've been through probably 20 different lawsuits about, you know, having a shopping cart. And apparently if you have a shopping cart on your website, you're violating thousands of patents out there. There's just that particular concept has just been patented beyond belief. Same with putting a Google map on your website. People have been sued over that. There's a patent for that. And it goes on and on. But these guys fought, and it became a better model for them. And it's, again, you have to have millions and millions of dollars. You got to have in order to fight these people. And you usually don't see that money. You don't get that money back either. But what happens is once you start defending yourself, patent trolls are less likely to come sue you. And that's the other side of the coin that I didn't mention. As soon as you settle with a patent troll, it's like you get put on a spammers list. And now you have all these other patent trolls coming after you going, oh, well, he's willing to pay money, so let's sue him too. And it really just opens the floodgates. And you're just never going to come out of that hole once it starts.
It's got to be public records. After I got divorced, I had a couple months where I had some money issues, and I got turned over to... I got sued by my apartment complex for rent because it was like the 15th, so they turned me over. So they filed a suit against me in small claims court. You go, you pay an extra $200, it's gone. But the week after that was filed, I started getting an order of magnitude of letters from lawyers, like and all these different people, because they just follow the court records of who's getting sued for what. And just start sending out direct mail pieces. So that's got to be what it is. They watch the court filings, and then they go, okay, vulnerable, 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 you know. And
you know, it's you know, it's funny. I you know how I got notified that I got sued?
How?
I had I had a lawyer call me who wanted to represent me. Oh. Like, I didn't even get the letter yet. There was a guy who wanted to represent me because he just follows. He follows the court filings. And, oh, this guy's getting sued. And that is how I got notified, by some lawyer who wanted to represent me. And then a few days later, I finally got the official paperwork.
So you were on the Mike O'Meara show. And yes. You were in the beautiful studios. What are the studios in D.C. called?
The Podcast Village.
Yeah, it's beautiful and it looks great. And it's every podcaster's dream what they've built there. And so I was watching you on that, talking to Mike O'Meara, who has a show called Political Persuasions. He's a very left-leaning fellow. Mm-hmm. And you were on, and he was like, why are you... I forget what was going on, but I don't know your politics, and you don't seem to me to be liberal or even conservative or even libertarian. You seem just to be like a very independent-minded person. I don't know where you would consider yourself on the spectrum.
I like to think I'm just open-minded, and of course, I've voted both Democrat and Republican. I know a lot of people probably are like one way or the other, and I've always been that way, but this whole patent thing has been just eye-opening, and I know we're getting to this story that I told on the Mike O'Meara show, and you know that kind of makes me not want to have government in my life. It makes me not want to have big government, which I think kind of leans towards the libertarian way, because to be honest, I think Republicans and Democrats want big government at this point.
Yeah, and so he is a very well-meaning individual, like most Americans, who think that government does good things for people. And he thinks that if he elects Democrats, then the world will get better because they're well-meaning and government is, you know, shared and blah, blah, blah. And so he was mentioning that, you know, if you have an opinion on social media, people are going to fight with you. And he was just saying, sometimes I want to unfollow you because you have a different opinion than him. And he's like, where does this anti-government sentiment come from? And then you told a story that I was at a local restaurant listening forever alone to this podcast, and my mouth was hanging open. I was like, I've got to get him on. I've got to get him to tell the story, because it's nobody creates libertarians better than the government of the United States or state governments. So so it goes all the way back to when you were an investor, and I'll let you tell the story.
Well, yeah, a stock market investor. So a friend of mine, this happened before TMSoft. I started another company with a couple friends, and my friend came to me, and he's a very smart guy, PhD engineer, has a ton of different degrees, and he brought me this chart, and he said, hey, I've come up with an algorithm that if we implement this, if you took $1 and invested it in the stock market, it would be worth $1 billion today, 5 years later. Mm. So that's what you call backtesting, and you're basically coming up with an algorithm that will trade the market on your behalf. And it's really a cool idea because you remove the human decisions out of trading, and it's all algo based. And I was like, sold. I was like, this looks fun. I want to code this up. So we started a company. We were in our 30s. None of us were married. None of us had kids. And we're just like, all right, let's throw a bunch of money in. We got some savings. Let's just throw equal amount in. There was three of us. And we kind of seeded our own company. We didn't get outside investors or anything. And I wrote the code. And so every morning my code would wake up and it would trade the stock market, and it was exciting, man. It was like you would see it go up, you'd see it go down, and have these big swings. And
that's how I felt with Bitcoin for about 3 months this summer.
I hope you didn't buy too high.
Oh no, I bought a little high and sold very high, and then was glad about it. But I made like $150. But yeah, but I get the feeling. I get the rush.
As being a tech guy, one of my friends called me. He's like, "Hey, I bought in at $15,000. I think it was a good idea." I was like, "I don't think so. You should get out." And sure enough, it just kept tanking. Yeah. But I never bought any of the Bitcoin. But so this program I was writing, it was making, you know, tons of trades all throughout the day. We ran it for a good couple months, And, you know, it was making a little bit of money, and it was just exciting and fun. And one day I woke up to check on the software, to check on the program, and I realized it aired out because there was no funds in the account. And it was very confusing. I logged into the brokerage account, and it was a $0 balance. And there was no real indication of what happened. There was a small transaction, well, big transaction, there was one transaction where it was just all taken out. And it didn't say where it went. It had a little memo that just said C support, letter C support on it. And so I called all my partners and I said, hey, did you take the money? No. Then I called the brokerage. I'm like, what happened? Where's the money? And they're like, yeah, this is really weird. We got served by the government to seize all your assets. The government seized all your assets. And the C support stands for child support. And I'm like, what? This is a company. The companies don't have kids. And there's three of us. What's going on?
And did any of you have kids?
No. No kids. Never married. The government just seized all the assets. And the only reason they gave was child support. So they're like, yeah, we thought this was strange. There's nothing we can do. The state of Texas, you know, seize the assets. You have to call the attorney general there and to discuss it. And so I called them, and the guy on the phone was like, yeah, this was really weird. This came from the state of West Virginia, and there was nothing. We thought it was kind of strange, but there's nothing we could do. We just have to seize the assets and give it to West Virginia. So then I finally, after many phone calls, get a hold of Child Support Services in West Virginia. And she goes, yeah, we seize the assets because the account owner matches the Social Security number of this deadbeat dad. And I'm like, what? This is a company. This is an EIN number, right? Because with a company, you have an EIN number. It's a 9-digit number. People have Social Security numbers. It's a 9-digit number.
Right.
But the dashes are in different places. Well, guess what? In the government database where they track all this, it's just a number. There's no dashes. There's no way for them to tell a company from a person. So they thought this account, this stock trading account, was a deadbeat dad's account that owed money for
now,
child support.
Can I ask how much money was taken out of the account?
It was around $40,000, I think.
Oh boy. He was really deadbeat.
Well, so that's the other thing is the lady from West Virginia, the child support services lady, she said, you know, that this guy was an out of work roofer. And she told me a lot about these people, and it's just like, well, why in the world would you think an out of work roofer would own a stock trading account? Like, why does that not concern you? Does that make sense? And especially it was in Texas. This guy lives in West Virginia. Is that strange? She's like, yeah, a little bit. And I was like, well, does this happen a lot? Does this particular thing happen where you mix up people and companies? And she goes, well, more than you would care to know. You know, it's like unbelievable. They can't tell the difference between a company and a person. They're just pushing a button, Chris. I mean, she pushing a button and seizing assets. Now,
but I also like that when you called, she gave you all of the information about the other person, too. Like, there's no regard for privacy either.
Yes. 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 I was, and of course it gets worse. So you heard the rest of the story.
Right.
But so the money was never distributed. And thankfully, because if it was, I don't know if I would have ever got it back. I would have probably had to sue the state of West Virginia. So luckily, they still had the money. And so it was safe and they were going to give it back to us. The reason they didn't distribute it right away to the mother of these kids was because when they told her that this money existed, that this account existed, and they were going to seize it, both the mother and the father got extremely excited, and the father even said, half of that money's mine. So that's a little bit of a red flag. I mean, if it was really his money, he wouldn't be saying half of that money's mine.
Right. I just love that you know this. I love that they told you all of this, and that just in that moment you must have been. I would have been. I don't know if I, at that point I would have laughed. I would have been furious, and then I would have laughed at that part.
Yeah, I can laugh at it now, Chris, now that we got the money back. But then it gets worse because I got the money back. They sent a bunch of checks, and we deposited. We ended up shutting the company down. I don't want to share. Mainly because, like, I don't want my company's EIN number to match this guy's number.
Yeah.
So we ended up shutting the company down. But here's the craziest thing, talking about privacy. The lady gave up my information, gave up my name and my phone number. So guess what happened a week later in the morning when I was heading to work? Ring. I had a landline at the time. This lady calls me up. The deadbeat dad's wife calls me on the phone and says, "You don't know who I am, but I just want you to know that money would have really benefited me. And, you know, I've got 3 kids and I lost my job and I'm going to jail and I needed that money." And I'm just like, "Okay, well, this wasn't your money." And she's like, "I know that." And I was like, "It's not even my money. It's a company, right? It's a company with multiple people." And she was like, "I get that. I just wanted to ask you if I could have some money." And at that point, I was pretty furious. And of course, I said no. I mean, this whole thing ruined this company. You know,
the sob story about going to jail and 3 kids and the deadbeat dad didn't warm your heartstrings, did it?
No, and this was my favorite phone number, so of course I had to disconnect that phone line, and so all these things. I couldn't believe they violated my privacy. They gave up my name. They gave up my number, and I ended up shutting down my company. Luckily, I got the money back, but it was eye-opening because how often does this happen, or has it ever been abused? And it was scary. That's when it really scared me that there's people in the government that have all of our accounts listed. And by the way, I didn't tell you that part. She knew exactly the balances and all of, like, we had more than one bank account. She said, "Oh," she goes, "this bank account had this much, this one, the stock account had this much." And so we decided to just go for the one with the most money and not take the other one. And she read off the, and I was just like, "This is crazy." So all of these people, the child support services, who knows, however other like government agencies have access to this information, but it's just right there for everyone to see, and they can just seize it without, you know, any kind of due diligence or double checking or asking if is it a company or who owns this account. They didn't ask a single question. They just seized the account. It's crazy.
I wish I could say that this is a mind-blowing, unique story to me, but doing what I do and having done this podcast for so long and then having previously worked for years in libertarian politics, I've heard stories like this on a monthly, sometimes weekly basis. I mean, it is the government as an entity is its own worst enemy, and it's full of well-meaning people. But at the end of the day, it's so incompetent and or just so mind-blowingly backwards that mm-hmm. when you interact with it, there's a reason that our Facebook page has the top 4 jobs are military, police officers, lawyers, like it's all people and teachers, people who work for the government or work with the government. They just can't take it. And so, of course, they become libertarians. I mean, it's... So at
any child support services?
Yeah, exactly. So at that point, were you just like, did you take the red pill at that point? You just started watching V for Vendetta all the time?
No, shockingly, I didn't get into politics. That wasn't enough. I mean, obviously, that taught me that I didn't like government. You know, it made it. The red flag was there. Like, I don't like that the government has access to this level of information? Does that mean my, and even today I'm like, is my money safe in my personal account? Could this happen again? If it's that easy to just have your, all your assets, do I need to like get a safe and put some cash in it? You know, these are all the things you think about. Like, what if this happened again? And like, you're just completely liquidated and you have zero. What would you do? So it's a little scary.
And you think about Greece, for instance, when Greece just passed a law during all of the years of the bailouts and all that, they just took a haircut of like 15% of every person's bank account. And they just passed a law, and all of a sudden, 15% of what was in your bank account was theirs and was withdrawn. So if you had $100, they took 15. If you had $1 million, they took 150. I mean, it would just, and I may be wrong in that particular number, but I mean, if you're in lean financial times, this is what states do. It's not America's better, they'll never do that. It's no, that's exactly how it works now.
Yeah.
The idea of American exceptionalism doesn't apply to our government.
It's scary. It's scary. And, you know, even before then, it's funny because now that I've gone through that and I've gone through the patent troll stuff, you start thinking back to like earlier in your career. And of course, you know, I'm in my 40s now, and that's when I was dealing with the patent troll stuff. I was in my 30s when I was dealing with the big government taking over, seizing my accounts. And then in my 20s, I actually worked for the federal government. And it's interesting because now that I think back on this, I remember getting in, my manager brought me into her office and said, "Hey, Todd, you know, this is federal government." She goes, we've coming up on the end of the fiscal year, and we've got to spend this money or else we're going to lose it. And so this is where I learned the term, you know, use it or lose it. That's how the federal government operates. And she goes, "Yeah, we got like $1,000 or $1 million. And I'm like 22. And she's like, do you need anything? You know, and I'm like, we got this million. And at the time I was just like, wow, I would love to just buy all new computers and create a lab and just teach myself how to use all this stuff. It had nothing to do with like optimizing the government, making the government more efficient. I was just going to like buy a bunch of stuff and play with it. And thinking back to that, it was, you know, it was only $1 million. Yeah, right. But think about, this was a small government department. Just think about like expand that over every department in the federal government. Man, we are wasting so much money. And so Now I think back at that. At the time, I was just like, woohoo, spend some money. It's not mine. Let's have fun. And now I think about it and I'm like, man, that's just not right. We've got to fix this use it or lose it system. I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah. All right. Well, Todd Moore, tell the people where they can buy your apps. If you've got a website or social media, this is plug time. Tell the people how they can connect with you.
Yeah, if you just go onto your app store and search for TMSoft, you'll see White Noise, you'll see Playapod. I'm working on those actively, and I would love for you to try them out. Maybe listen to your favorite podcast, the Chris Spangle Show, Libertarians, all of it. We don't censor any of it. You can add manual RSS feeds to Playapod. Really appreciate it. It's totally free. I don't even make money off of it. No ads or nothing. It's kind of a passion project. And if you need to sleep better, check out the White Noise app.
And as always, you know, brown noise and cat purrs. That's where it's at.
Mix it up.
That's right. All right, Todd Moore, thanks so much for coming on the program. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks, Chris. Really enjoyed it.
All right, cool. Well, thank you so much for...